You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the issue of the 15th to the 21st of March 2018. I'm Chris Havergal. I'm joined by data editor Simon Baker, features editor Paul Drum, and deputy news editor Ellie Bothwell. This week, does soaring demand for higher education in England imperil its uncapped admission system? That's the warning issued in a new report from the Higher Education Policy Institute, which predicts that an additional 300,000 university spaces will be needed by 2030. Simon will be discussing that. In a sector where men still have a firm grip on the most senior roles, is there such a thing as an academic sisterhood? And do female academics look out for each other? That's our lead feature this week, and Paul will be discussing that. And then finally, free tuition has been widely welcomed in South Africa, with the bulk of families now able to access free university education. But former President Thabo Mbeki has been raising concerns that the policy creates problems as well as offering solutions. Ellie met him and we'll be discussing that also. But firstly, let's start with the lead story in this week's magazine. Simon, this is a report from the Higher Education Policy Institute that predicts a significant increase in demand for higher education in England over the next decade and a bit up to 2030. I mean, firstly, what are they predicting is going to happen in terms of admissions trends over the next few years?
This is all based on sort of the demographic trends which you already know about among sort of young people in England over the next 10 years. So basically, it's what I like to call Baby Boom 3. It's if you think of the grandchildren of the original baby boomers, right, people just born after the war, then although we've had a bit of a demographic dip in the number of 18-year-olds, we've got a lot more coming in the 2020s, and they're all at school at the moment, and that's why there's a squeeze on school places. And what Hepi is saying is that if you take that on its own, you're going to need another 50,000 extra places.
Yep.
But the key sort of driver which pushes it to about 300,000 places is what they're saying it will need in terms of extra places by 2030, is that the participation rate, so the percentage of young people that go to university, is just going to keep going up, as it has done for the past 15 years. I mean, this is the kind of sort of central talking point, I suppose, about it. And something I pushed the authors of the report a couple of times on is that, you know, is that really going to happen? Is England going to keep, is its participation rate going to keep going up? Blair famously said he wanted 50% of people to go to university, young people to go to university. We've reached that point virtually now.
Yeah, far off.
So, Barham Bakandria, from the president of HEPI, who's one of the co-authors, sort of said to me, well, we're still behind other advanced nations. If you look at OECD data, yes, we're behind some countries still that got very high participation rates, but we're ahead of a lot of others. So I suppose that's the big sort of discussion for me, is that going to keep going up?
Nevertheless, it does include also a hit from Brexit. That is factored into their working. So it's not all just sort of going up and up and up. They do also predict that Brexit will have
an effect. Yeah, we'll hit the kind of demand there will be for places from the EU, because you know, we might end up putting up fees to international fee level, and if they can't get loans to pay for that, then that will hit it better. So, but I mean, the other thing that flows for this, so we assume that you will need 300,000 extra places, and it is pretty plausible that could happen, and they think they're sort of being conservative, then the other question is then, how do you fund it, given the government is already struggling to sort of work out how to fund higher education? Has just started a review in which they're going to attempt to sort of try and ease the burden on students, you would have thought, because that's the big issue politically. So that's going to cost more, the taxpayer more. So if you're then trying to fund 300 extra places, 1,000 extra places, you've got a really dicey political stew, I suppose.
I mean, the HEPI report suggesting that you might need to put the cap on admissions back on in England. I mean, that's something that has happened effectively in Australia, which operated with a demand-driven system for a number of years and found that the cost was pretty uncomfortable, you know, in their case for the government in particular. You know, how likely do the authors think that is, and what are the potential consequences that flow from that?
Well, they both had Dinah Beach, HEPI's policy and advocacy director, had a slightly different view to Barham. So Barham thought, yeah, you're going to have to put the cap back on probably because you just can't, otherwise you can't square this funding circle. Yeah. Dinah's a bit more optimistic and sort of said, you know, if you're kind of intelligent about provision as well, and universities kind of a bit more smart about how they offer different courses, you might get more shorter courses, you might get more online, you get more, you might have more technical type degrees, high degree apprenticeships, you might get more people studying from home. If all of these things kind of happen at the same time, then you can possibly address the demand sort of issue that way. But you know, at the end of the day, it all costs money, so you're going to have to find money for per, you know, if each student brings an extra cost to the taxpayer, then you're going to have to find that money from somewhere. So you just end up in the same kind of the same questions about how you find the money for the system, I think.
Certainly looks like some difficult decisions ahead. You can read that story on page 6 and 7 of this week's magazine. And while you're here, Simon, it's worth asking you about Times Higher Education Most International Universities ranking, which was released this week, topped this year by École Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne, swapping places with its Swiss neighbour ETH Zurich, the rest of the top five being made up by the University of Hong Kong, the National University of Singapore, and the UK's top entrant, Imperial College London. The full listing is available on timeshighereducation.com. But Simon, for the magazine, you've been digging into the data behind this exercise in a bit more detail and looking at what it says about the state of internationalisation in different disciplines and different countries. What did you find?
Well, I sort of decided to look at the data that we have in the rankings slightly differently to look at. So we have the international pillar in the rankings, which measures essentially how many overseas students, staff, and how much co-authorship there is going on at a particular university. And if you look at that data by subject area and by countries of the universities that are in this kind of ranking, you start to see that while some countries, some of these internationally open universities are across the board very good at kind of having a globalised student cohort and staff and that kind of thing and collaboration, other countries is kind of quite different kind of pictures according to subject. And what one thing that was interesting is if you look at the kind of elite institutions in countries in Asia that aren't actually that good at internationalization, like China and South Korea, you look at sort of arts and humanities and social science research, there's more kind of internationalization going on there than say in engineering or physical sciences, which is the complete opposite of actually if you look at some Western countries. Which is, and if you want to talk to some experts about this, what seemed to come out is that if you think about scholars maybe in the West that want to find out more about Chinese culture or study China, they're going to be more likely to be contacting Chinese universities and saying, can I collaborate with you? Students might want to go to, international students from the UK and the US might be more likely to go to China on in those kind of subjects to find out more, whereas in other subjects is China wanting to collaborate with the West because they've got sort of, so there's kind of different patterns going on there that kind of could explain the reasons behind that data, but it's certainly interesting.
Yeah, another sign of the shifting sands of global higher education. You can read that analysis on page 24 to 25 and again online. Now our lead feature this week looks at whether there is such a thing as an academic sisterhood. Do female academics look to help each other out, and if so, how far does it go to redressing the male advantage in the sector that still seems to persist? This is a piece that was written for us by Holly Else. But Paul, perhaps you know, you can offer some thoughts on, you know, what answers do it offer to those questions?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's worth saying that, you know, talking a bit about the context of the piece, you know, obviously it comes with all the revelations about sexual harassment recently, but I think probably more generally the idea that there's so much sort of unconscious bias around that, you know, maybe sort of progress in gender equality is actually less advanced than was initially thought. Mm. So obviously, I mean, the sisterhood idea obviously goes back to the 60s, but we're looking at, you know, whether, you know, the time has come to perhaps revive that notion in light of, you know, the struggles to achieve gender equality. I mean, in terms of the specific answers to the questions, does a sisterhood exist? The answer to that's probably. Women were less likely to think it exists, funnily enough, although it's fair to say that a lot fewer men actually entered the survey that Holly set up to probe some of these questions.
There's a survey that sort of lies behind this feature.
There is, yes. Women were more likely than not to say that one did exist, although men were more likely to think that one existed. Mm. As to whether one should exist, I think the overwhelming answer to that is yes, according to women at least. Nearly 80% of them think that one should exist. And when you look at the comments in the survey, you know, most of the reasons are to do with the perception, at least, that you know, a male sort of brotherhood, if you like,
the old
still
boys
exists.
Network.
Old yeah. boys network, yeah. In effect, yes, still exists. I mean, whether it really does or whether that is just an artifact of, you know, unconscious bias, to which obviously women are also prone, is another matter. But yeah, I mean, this was definitely seen as a way to counterbalance that.
Mm. I mean, was there a sense of actually how effective it was as a, you know, in terms of counterbalancing that?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it depends what you mean by sisterhood, doesn't it, really? I mean, on the one hand, lots of people that Holly spoke to talked about things like, you know, mentoring and, you know, sort of female support networks, sort of informal support networks, and sharing stories and advice and that kind of thing. I mean, that's one kind of sisterhood. There is obviously a slightly more hard-nosed kind that would advocate things like choosing a female candidate for a job over a male one, perhaps all other things being equal, if ever they actually are equal in reality. Yeah. Very few people, I don't think anybody Holly spoke to actually specifically advocated going that far in terms of sort of positive discrimination by women towards other women, but obviously that is one option.
But, I mean, it's also worth saying that the feature also covers examples of cases where female academics are actually found, you know, not to be supporting other female academics, but, you know, actively, it could be argued, sort of looking to undermine them. And this is talking about the sort of the queen bee syndrome, which, you know, we've heard about before.
That's right, yes. And Holly spoke to an expert on the queen bee syndrome, who does seem to think that it exists, although it isn't something to which women are only prone, because there are similar versions of it for ethnic minorities and things. And the general driver is that, you know, if you're a member of some kind of minority, you often feel the need to kind of adopt the habits of the majority group and sort of almost go beyond what they do and be even more sort of discriminatory towards other members of the minority. So, yeah, I mean, that does potentially seem to be an issue. And then there's the whole idea that, you know, by suggesting that there should be a sisterhood, you know, you're, in a way, you're just putting more pressure on women when they're already under a lot of pressure to do, or at least they feel more obliged to do things like mentoring and some of that support stuff than men apparently do. And, you know, by suggesting that they need to be looking out for other women as well, you know, it's just sort of piling on the pressure and, again, expecting them to be nicer than you'd expect a man in their position to be.
OK, well, yeah, certainly raises a lot of interesting issues, and that piece starts on page 38 of this week's magazine. Paul, thanks for discussing that. Finally, Ellie, you've been meeting up with Thabo Mbeki, the former South African president. He's been talking about perhaps the sort of final policy initiative of Jacob Zuma, one of his successors, which was to introduce free tuition for the majority of South African families. If you've got combined annual income of approximately less than £20,500 in sterling, you're now able to attend university in South Africa for free, and you get maintenance funding. This has been widely welcomed in South Africa, Ellie, but when you were speaking to Thabo Mbeki, he was also highlighting some of the potential challenges that a policy like this threw up. So what did he tell you?
Yeah, so I think the main issue was really that there hasn't been a kind of comprehensive review of higher education funding in the country, and he was sort of saying, you know, you can't deal with something like HE funding or education funding in general in a kind of piecemeal fashion. So he was saying one of the issues he thought would amount would be that there'd be quite high dropout rates of students. Mm. You know, if you're, it's all very well saying, well, you know, you can all come to university for free, but actually if you're not addressing the kind of barriers in the kind of lower levels of education in schools, then, you know, he said students don't necessarily have the grounding in education, and, you know, they won't be able to progress through university. Another issue he highlighted was sort of problems of capacity within universities. So he said it was likely that if suddenly now a whole group of people can more easily access university, you know, that you know, most of them will be likely to do so, and therefore, you know, how a university is going to suddenly deal with, you know, huge spikes in student enrolment. So yeah, I mean, I think he sort of did seem to, you know, I don't think he was kind of against the whole idea of free higher education per se, but I think he felt that it wasn't a policy that had necessarily been kind of managed holistically, you know, across the education sector, and it might throw up these sorts of issues.
Of course, Thabo Mbeki was speaking at a conference at IE University in Madrid, and he was also talking, if I understand rightly, you know, more broadly about some of the sort of trends in African higher education more broadly and how they link into sort of global trends. You know, what was he talking about more broadly on a continental level?
Yeah, so he was saying about the kind of the way in which African countries are kind of collaborating with each other, and also looking to collaborate more with countries outside of the continent. And he sort of suggested, I mean, the it's worth mentioning that the kind of main theme of the conference was kind of looking at I don't know, global partnerships kind of in a kind of post-Brexit, post-Trump sort of world. And he was saying that, you know, maybe countries like the US and the UK could learn from, you know, African countries that actually are really looking to cooperate. And he also spoke about a Pan-African University Initiative, which was set up while he was president. And it sort of aimed at widening access to higher education. So the idea is that different universities across African countries would kind of be labelled as hubs for certain subjects, and kind of in return for having this label, they'd be required to kind of accept students from any other African countries.
Okay, interesting stuff. Thanks for that, Ellie. You can find that piece on page 17 of the magazine, and also, like all the articles we've been discussing, they can be found online at www.timeshighereducation.com. You can also find us all over social media. We're on Twitter, LinkedIn and Facebook and elsewhere as well. But that's all we've got time for in this week's Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.